This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. The City of Cohasset Parks and Rec Department offer woodsy walks at Tioga every Monday and Thursday at 1:30 p.m. Free and open to all. Meet at the Tioga Recreation Area parking lot. The McCroskey Art Center's Fall Studio Tour is Saturday, October 4th from 10 to 4. There are 9 different studios with 21 participating artists. Maps can be found at the McCroskey Art Center in Grand Rapids or online at mccroskeyartcenter.org/studio-tour. Native Defense presents the second annual Our Voices Restored community event Saturday, October 11th from 11 to 3 at the Beaux Arts Ballroom on the campus of Bemidji State University. There will be panel discussions, local music, a community meal, and resource table. Free and open to all.
Hi there, friends. It's time for an hour of story and song. We have a very special edition of Stay Human today. It's the first of a two-parter. We need two shows to showcase the terrific storytelling concert we put on last week at Clockout Brewing in Grand Rapids. 9 of the Stay Human tellers worked together for 4 sessions of workshopping the stories told that night at the concert. Stories of pack sackers and of working for world peace, of finding human connection at the jail, and getting health advice from celebrity columnists. We'll hear a few of those stories in this hour. I'm Michael Goldberg. Please stay with us. I want to tell you about the trip that I took to the fabulous island of Crete in the Aegean Sea. I've been thinking about it all week, thinking about the trip and also thinking about how to tell you about it, because there's just so much that I want to put in this tale of our trip to Crete, like the Greek Orthodox Church that was across the road from our rooftop patio that had loudspeakers sending the chants and the prayers all over town at all hours of the day and night, and the priest who we could see behind the garden wall sneaking a cigarette. And I have to tell you about the raki, which is this brandy that they make locally there in Crete. It's made out of grape skins, and it's everywhere. We went to rent a car for the day, and after we signed all the papers, showed him our license, everything was set, he said, "Oh, no, no, don't go yet." And he goes away, and he comes back with a tray full of shot glasses of this raki and insists that we all join him. Yamas! And he hands us the key, and off we go. That night, in fact, at the restaurant, the waitress came, not the one who had brought us our food, but a younger, more friendly waitress, came to our table with a tray full of complimentary shot glasses of raki for everybody, including her. And we thanked her, and, well, yamas. And we visited with her a little bit, and about 10 minutes later, she comes back with another tray, shot glasses full of raki, and a little pitcher in case anybody wants a refill, including one for her. Yamas, we're having just a swell time visiting, and she's a hoot, and we're all laughing. And when she comes back a third time with a tray full of complimentary shots of raki, I said, "Do you, like, own this place?" Because she's just standing around visiting with us. She says, "No, but my mom's boyfriend owns it, so it's okay." I got to tell you more about her, and I got to tell you about the old guy we met in the bay. There's just so many things that I got to include in this tale about our trip to the island of Crete. But it gets a little bit like, you know, you ask somebody what time it is, and they want to give you the history of Switzerland. I've never been to Switzerland, but history is a big part of being in Crete. There's the ruins, and there's the Minotaur's labyrinth, and the history of the house where we were staying, and the kitchen in that house. This is a story that actually includes the kitchen sink. I was thinking about this the other day. I was washing my own kitchen floor. I don't know about you, but sometimes I tend to put that off a little bit, you know, and it gets kind of grody, and finally get around to it and work away at it and get it all nice and clean and stand back to admire the job I did. And then I see all this dirt that I couldn't see before because it was covered with dirt. So I'm down, you know, scraping away at this little piece of jelly and that food stain, and there's all these white dog hairs that are gathering up in the corner. My dog is white. She's got a beautiful white coat. You should see her when she's bounding through the woods. She's just gorgeous in the green. Of course, in the wintertime, we have to put a blaze orange vest on her, or else we'd never be able to see her from the trail. Another cool thing about having a dog with a white coat, I can spot a wood tick on her from half the room away. We do give her tick medicine, of course, but she hates it. We have to grind the pills up and mix it with peanut butter, and then she wants to lick the peanut butter off the crumbs, you know. But I guess it works, because she comes in from the yard or the woods, you know, lots of ticks on her, and they go down and they figure out that she doesn't smell very good, I suppose, and then they come back up her coat, and I'm able to pick them off. And it's fun, but she does shed quite a bit. I have to keep cleaning off the bottom of the broom when I'm sweeping the floor, because the broom is now all full of this white dog hair. And when I put the broom away, I go back and, oh, I missed all that dog hair. I have to go get the broom again, you know. And for me, actually, telling a story like this is a little bit like sweeping the floor, because I think I've got it all done and it's all set, and then I keep finding all these pieces that I forgot to include, you know. I got to go and get them and work them in somehow. It just doesn't come easy to me, I think. My dad now, he could really tell a story. He loved to tell a story, he loved jokes. He would do all the voices and the accents, and then he would slice that punchline in right down to the bone. He was a salesman, and I'm thinking that's part of being a salesman, is to be that kind of guy where, like, he sold ticking for mattresses, and his customers were all factories that made mattresses, and I'm thinking that this mattress guy probably sees Sid coming in with his sample case, and he's already starting to smile because he knows he's going to get a good laugh, you know, and he does get a good laugh, and my dad gets the sale, and that's a really good storyteller. But that's not me. I'm just not a natural at this, which really is too bad, because I have this radio show. I could tell a story every week if I wanted to. I don't have to tell a story every week. All I have to do is bring in something that's exactly 59 minutes and 30 seconds long. But it's not too hard to back time it, because I use this really cool audio editing software. Sarah at the radio station walked me through the basics on it when I started the show. She said, "This is the way we do this now." I thought she hit the now a little hard. Because she knows I'm from a time when digital basically meant your fingers and toes. So if you wanted to do an edit back then, like say you interview somebody about the new mattress factory in town, and it's going okay, but at a certain point, the person you're interviewing, they go off on some kind of a tangent that just gets farther and farther away from the thing they're supposed to be talking to you about. That can happen sometimes, you know. So to edit it, you have to like run this open reel tape back and forth over the sound head, find the exact spot, take your wax crayon and mark it, and lift the tape into the device that has the razor blade on it. And by the time, before you're done, you got tape all over the floor, and you got a few strands of tape set aside because like this part should really go near the beginning. And it's just, it was nuts. But the way we do it now, the technical part is easy peasy. Of course, the having something to say that anybody might want to listen to part, that's as hard as it ever was. So I decided, as long as I got this radio show, I should try to get better at it. So I called up this guy, a well-known storyteller. He's got something going called the American School of Storytelling. Called him up, I said, "I'd like to take your class." And he said, "Sure, great. I got one coming up in June. It's four consecutive weekends." I didn't mention this American School of Storytelling, it's located in Minneapolis. Four consecutive weekends in June? I don't think so. I mean, the traffic's not going to be bad, but there is a reason that all of the Friday traffic is northbound, right? So I said, "Well, what would it take to get you up here?" And he's a very generous guy. He loves what he does. And he says, "Well, get some friends together and I'll come up and do a workshop." So that's what I did. I got some friends together. You're going to get to meet them here tonight. And we get into the workshop room and we're all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, or anyway, hoping that we have a tail. And he hands out this piece of paper. It's got a grid printed on it, like 50 little boxes. Down one side, it says things like work, home, fun, fear, play. And across the top, it has you at 5, you at 15, you at 25, you at 40. And we're supposed to fill in the grid rows by column. And these boxes are really little. You can only get a word or two in there. So, you know, but it was fun. It was a really fun trip down memory lane. I didn't exactly see what the point of that was, except then he comes with another piece of paper that's got the same kind of grid, only different headings for the rows and the columns, and we're supposed to take one of the little squares that's on the first sheet and blow it up into the whole sheet with all kinds of information and feelings and all sorts of stuff. And now, like, people are really starting to jive with it. You know, the room gets a little bit more excited and people start telling their stories back and forth, and I'm starting to feel a little more confident that, I probably can do this. And then he lays on us the 10 plot structures of a story, 10 of them. One of them we knew, we walked in with there with it. It was like just a straight ahead narrative, you know, like A, B, C, D. But then there's the flashback, and there's the retrograde, and there's the revelation, and there's some really trippy ones. There's the parallel story and the mirror story and the string of pearls. And by this time, my head is just spinning. I got so many ideas clanging around in there that I really can't hear myself think. But I feel like, okay, I'm ready. I'm going to charge off in every direction at once. And then he says, okay, Michael, I want you to get up and tell the story of your trip to the fabulous island of Crete, which I'd really like to do. Just as soon as I get that story together, I'm going to tell it to you all. Probably it's going to come to me sometime when I'm washing the kitchen floor. Till then, thank you for your patience.
So that's what they say, easy. Anyone can whistle any old day, easy. It's all so simple. Relax, let go, let fly. So a tango, I can read Greek, easy. I can slay a dragon any old week, easy. What's hard is simple, what's natural comes hard. Maybe you could show me how to let go, lower my guard, learn to be free.
Music by Stephen Sondheim. The storytelling coach and teacher we worked with was Lauren Neamey. He has spent his life performing stories and collecting them and coaching people on how to tell their own. Heck of a way to make a living. But, of course, he's had regular jobs, too. Lauren Neamey.
While I was in college, I held a number of jobs. I picked apples. I laid sod. But the most interesting job I had for a good long period was I drove taxi in Minneapolis at night from midnight till 9 in the morning. You got to see a lot of the city at that time. In those days in Minneapolis, well, I'm going to name three or four bars which no longer exist. One of them was the Copper Squirrel, where I picked up a guy, and an hour later, someone got shot. Yeah, okay. A place called Mousie's, where when I went in the door, the bartender handed me a slip and said, "This is where he goes," and pointed to a guy who had passed out. And finally, to one of the classics, the Carousel, where I had the honor of picking up John Berryman, the poet and teacher at the University of Minnesota, whose class I was taking during the day. But he was in no mood to talk. It was obvious I wasn't going to get an answer anyway, except for the question of, "Where did you say you wanted to go?" Three times I had to ask. The bars close. There's a wave that gets delivered. 2 o'clock in the morning, there's a wave of people who are coming back from parties. 3 o'clock in the morning, there's another wave of people who are definitely going back from parties or from wherever they were and want you to drop them off, not exactly at the address, but close, so they can make the decision of front door or back door. 4 or 5 in the morning, you begin to get people who are actually on their way to work. The real workers, right? Who, when you drop them off, they are going to do the janitorial work, or they're going to make the coffee, or they're going to start the machinery, so that when the suits and ties come in, it all looks like it's ready. And then finally, around 6 in the morning, you get the people who want to go to the airport. The most dangerous run of all. Not because of the people in the car, but because when you get to the airport, if you're wanting to wait for someone to take back downtown, there was a perpetual crap game waiting for your money. It was an education. One which had its odd moments, and the oddest moment of all was people would say, "Isn't it dangerous?" And I would say, "No." But in truth, I did get robbed once. Not at night. Another driver asked me to take his shift, and so I started work at 8 in the morning. And by 8:30, I picked up my first fare at the Radisson Hotel. And we had not gone a block before I looked in the rearview mirror and saw a pistol pointed at my head and a guy saying, "Give me what you've got." And I laughed. I said, "Buddy, you picked the wrong man." And I handed him $10 in change, which was everything I had. And then I thought, am I in trouble? But at that point, I heard the door open and close, and he ran off, and I called the dispatcher and said, "I've been robbed." And he said, "Stand in line. There are people who are trying to make a living."
Thanks to Lauren Nini. We'll hear from him again later in this hour. It was quite a treat to watch his teaching methods in the storytelling workshop. He listened to our stories, then asked probing questions and offered suggestions that went right to the heart of things and snapped everything into focus. One of the stories that evolved over a few days was this one, told live here by Rebecca Zemanski.
I also have a bit of a trip story to tell, but I did not make it quite as far. I made it to Duluth. This spring, I found myself very unexpectedly in Duluth in May in a beautiful room with a beautiful view that I was not really paying attention to. There was a lot going on. And when I try to explain how everything went wrong, I like to say, I have no one to blame but Meghan Markle. It might sound a little weird. She's not someone I've ever met. She is a famous actress who've married into British royalty. I have never met her, but this is where I tell you two things. When I am anxious, I like to be very prepared. So I was one of few people, you know, probably not a lot of university students were buying thermometers during COVID. I bought a pulse oximeter, things like that. I like to make sure I've got tools at hand when I think something's going on. And also, I like to read things cover to cover, and I found out that I could get a lot of information from celebrity articles about all kinds of random issues, including health issues, and it kind of became fun to flip to the back of the magazine between the biggest fashion editorials and the horoscopes. There's usually some kind of, you know, serious article, and I got kind of hooked on those, and so I ended up reading a lot about different health issues from time to time and had this little niche area of knowledge of who had different health issues and what they talked about them, and it helped sometimes when I was talking to the doctor about things I didn't know a lot about. So that became something I was working on. My husband and I came a little bit late to parenting, and I was very nervous about getting ready to become a parent, very, very nervous. So I thought, I'm going to be really prepared. And they talk to you a lot about why it's important to go to full term. And I thought, that's perfect. I'm going to have plenty of time. I'm going to be very prepared. We're going to have the nursery done. We're going to have the supplies. We're going to have the name picked out. We're going to think ahead. We're going to plan ahead. I know parenting will be unpredictable, but we are going to nail this first step. And I was due in June, and so by March and April, I was starting to get a little bit behind, but I thought, I'm going to be fine. We've got plenty of time. I was working on my registry, and my friend sent me an article. She said, this made me think of you, and it was a celebrity article. It was by Meghan Markle, and it was about something called post-eclampsia. Well, I knew about preeclampsia, and I knew about eclampsia. They both come from having high blood pressure, fever, and they can lead to seizures. The only cure is delivery. And I knew a lot about this because I had seen Downton Abbey. And I get this article and I think, there's a third one? And I'm like, okay. So I start reading and she's talking about it. And here's the thing, you can get home blood pressure cuffs. Perfect. I put it on my registry. I'm due at the end of June. My baby shower is June 1st. Perfect. We're gonna stick that in the nursery if I get it. We're good to go. I keep going. We're a little bit behind on things, but I'm going to make this work. And so I decided I'm going to go on maternity leave a little bit early. I was going to work. My boss said I could work through our big event of the season. I'm going to go out with a bang right after the hairball concert. And here's my plan. I'm going to sleep in that weekend. I'm going to wake up Monday. I am going to get things done. I am going to be the most prepared parent. So I sleep in Saturday, and I'm working on something on at the kitchen table, and I stand up, and the room goes, and I start to tip over, and I'm like, well, that's weird. And I said, I should find my thermometer. Everything's fine. I don't have any other symptoms, but I'm like, well, I don't use the pulse oximeter that much, so let's pull that out. That's normal, and that's great. And then I see, a week or two earlier, I had gotten this notification from Amazon, and it said, something on your registry is half price. Excellent. And I had bought that blood pressure cuff, and it's sitting there on the dining room table, and I thought, okay, let's break that out. This is an excuse to use the shiny new toy. And we hook it all up, and I'm noticing that the wording on the manual is a little bit interesting. It's a little stilted, and I'm starting to wonder why this was 50% off. And we plug it in, and the numbers come up really weird, 155 over 103. Yeah. So I have to admit, I didn't fully understand blood pressure at this point. I kind of would look at my doctor or the nurse when they're giving me the readings, and I'm like, okay, I think we're fine. They're not looking worried. And this seemed really weird, and we said, okay, we're gonna wait a couple hours. And for the next 24 hours, we took my blood pressure semi-regularly. And at some point, and I'm taking a picture so I don't forget what the numbers are. And at some point, we text a family member who's a nurse. And she says, you know, if it's still like that on Sunday evening or Monday morning, I think you should let your doctor know. And we did on Monday morning. And they said, why don't you come in? And I said, you know, I'm pretty sure that I did the thing you're not supposed to do. I bought something off the internet and I looked up my symptoms. And they said, why don't you come in? I said, okay. And I sat there in the ER waiting room, and I felt so silly about this. I read something online. I bought something online. I looked up my symptoms. And I almost left, but I'm already there. It's a 40-minute drive. And they check me in and they hook me up and the tone shifts a little bit. And I'm like, well, I just need to stay calm and they're going to tell me what to do. We're good. I have so much. I'm going to go home. I'm going to be so prepared by the end of this week. And then they said, well, we don't deliver here before 36 weeks. We're looking to see if they have availability in Duluth or Minneapolis because the only you're preeclamptic and the only cure is delivery. We don't have a name picked out. We don't have the nursery done. We're not ready. I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to do breathing exercises. And the next thing I know, I'm on my way to Duluth. So the next 24 hours are a little bit of a blur. Magnesium does that to you, apparently. But the team was excellent. They were very clear. They kept saying, this is what we're going to do, and this is why. Occasionally, they'd say, is that okay with you? And I would say, I don't have a medical degree. I read Cosmo. But they were fantastic. They explained what was going on. And so on Wednesday afternoon, I was holding this very tiny little guy. My friend was in the room and got a picture of the three of us before they whisked him down the hall. We had talked about it ahead of time. My husband stayed with him and my friend stayed with me. And at one point the room emptied and everything kind of slowed down. And I realized I had this most amazing view that I had totally forgotten about, totally ignored. If this place was a hotel, we're about 7 floors up. There's Lake Superior. It's gorgeous. It is a room with a view. And so when I explain why my baby's birth certificate is not the way I planned it, why we didn't have the name on time and all that stuff, I say, I have no one to blame but Meghan Markle, and I am very grateful.
Thanks to Rebecca Zemanski. She brought along the audience's youngest member at 4 months of age, and I'm guessing that might not have been the last time little Anthony will hear the story of the day he arrived.
You're my little potato, you're my little potato, you're my little potato, they dug you up, you come from underground. The world is big, so big, it's very big. To you, it's new to you. You're my little potato, you're my little potato, you're my little potato, dug you up. You come from underground. Let's talk about root crops and lamb chops. And things to eat like apples and cheese and bananas and cream, jellies and butter. It's late at night. I hope this little bottle helps you go to sleep. They must have grown you wild to make a grown man a child. I'll go and play in the mud to be with you, my spud. Potato, when you came out looking red as a beet, you had wrinkles on the bottoms of your feet. Oh, oh, now you are so sweet, potato. You're my sweet potato. You're my sweet potato. Dug you up. You come from underground. You smile. The world is small, so small, it's very small.
little potato. You're my little potato. You're my little potato. They dug you up. You come from underground. You're my little potato. You're my little potato. You're my little potato.
Metamora with one of my favorite lullabies. You are tuned to your Northern Community Radio, KAXE KBXE, people powered radio telling the stories of Northern Minnesota. We're streaming at kaxe.org. Check out that website for local news and features that you may have missed. And if you're not already a supporter of this independent service, you can become a member at that site with a voluntary donation. Makes a big difference around here, especially this year. Today on Stay Human, we're featuring some of the stories told live at the Authentic Voice Storytelling Concert held last week. That show received support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and it was a blast. Standing room only, and not a lot of that. Good beer, good friends, good stories. It all just goes together. I hope you'll tell one of your own stories next time you're raising a glass with friends. Up next, recorded live at Clockau, teacher, writer, and storyteller Teresa Alto with this.
If you live in or near Grand Rapids, you have an opinion about the new jail. Some people are offended that we have a jail right in the center of our town. It's a little bit too much like a cultural landmark. It's a little bit too visible. Other people feel that the new jail is maybe a little bit too nice for the people in there. Criminals, they might say, shouldn't just be lounging around all day watching TV on the taxpayers' dime. Well, I can tell you, it's not particularly comfortable. On a weekly basis, I go into that windowless fortress to teach a class called Write to Hope on mindful writing to female inmates there. I go in the door and lock my coat and cell phone in a little locker. Then I go up to security and make conversation about the weekend with the deputies there, as I put my notebooks and folders and books on the x-ray conveyor belt for the x-ray machine and walk through the metal detector. And then I'm in the court administration building. Then I turn left into the jail annex. There are machines that you can put money on inmates' canteens so they can buy things like coffee or a thermal undershirt to keep warm, things that they're not provided at the jail. And there's a little room with kiosks that people's friends or family members can use to have visitation with their loved ones. And then there's the door, the locked door to the jail proper. I buzz the door. I'm asked what I'm there for. I say, I'm Teresa Alto, here for a 9 a.m. Write to Hope class. Let me see your badge. I show my badge to wherever the camera is. The door buzzes open. I'm in a little entryway with another locked door. That door buzzes open. And then I go down a little hallway, and to the left is the area where the library and program rooms are, also locked. So I'm buzzed into the program area. And then finally, I'm allowed into one of the program rooms, which is also kept locked. I decided to start volunteering there after taking a tour of the jail about 2 years ago when it was in the process of construction. It was dusty and a little hard to picture exactly what was going to be where, but the jail administrator who gave me the tour pointed out the area that an inmate would be in when they were first brought in. Often they're going through detox. close to a social worker, otherwise isolated. He pointed out an example of one of the pods that improved the ability for inmates to be able to socialize with each other from the old jail when they weren't in lockdown in their cells. And the gym, and he pointed out the skylights where there was some natural light coming in. It's a state mandate that jails have natural light, and you can satisfy that with skylights. And he pointed out the kiosk that was going to improve safety for the jail and the inmates by having all visitation be over video. I was impressed, and he was justifiably proud of the way that the jail was improving the ability to provide programming. There was going to be much expanded programming. And his concern for the safety of the inmates was real, and he was justifiably proud of that. But I went away disturbed that there was no outdoor space, and that not only was there no outdoor space, you couldn't even see the outdoors from in the jail. There are no windows. And when you're in there, and you can think about this, this is probably arguably going to be the lowest moment of a person's life. There's no opportunity to have face-to-face visitation with someone that you love and trust. All of it is over video or text and surveilled. So I realized it's kind of important that they see somebody besides other inmates and jail staff. Thus, one of the most important things about programming is that ordinary people are coming into the jail. So I decided I wanted to do that. So a few years ago, I went to an exhibit in town called We Are All Criminals. It was a photography exhibit. And in each photograph, there was a picture of someone from chin to hip. And in the picture, the person would be holding a sign. And on that sign, there would be a crime that the person had committed at some point in his or her life. And under that, the career that the person had because they'd never been caught for that crime. There was a notebook at the exhibit that invited viewers to write down, to confess, a crime that they had committed that they had not been held accountable for. I wrote in that notebook about shoplifting for 2 years in my early adolescence. This wasn't a one-time thing like taking money from my mom's purse or stealing a candy bar. I did it repeatedly. I took small things like makeup and candy, things I could hide, slip into a pocket or hide in my hand. Took also things like bras and underwear, shirts, things I could take into a dressing room and put my clothes over and then just walk out. I was good at it. I never got caught. The women that I work with each week got caught, or to be more accurate, they got arrested. They're mostly, over half of the people in the jail are in there prior to adjudication. That means that they're in jail because they couldn't make bail. If you're arrested and you can make bail, you get to, it's certainly very stressful, I'm sure, but you continue to live your normal life. You live in your house. You have private conversations with people. You continue working at your job. You continue taking care of your kids. But if you can't make bail, you're in jail. And the other people, many of the other people who are there for probation violations. Often relapses into drinking or drug use. Sometimes because they couldn't make appointments with probation officers, because they didn't have transportation, sometimes unpaid fines. Before I went there for the first time a little over a year ago, I was really nervous. I didn't know who I would be facing. If not hardened criminals, I pictured women that were tough, who had had a much less sheltered life than I had had thus far, and maybe they wouldn't be able to relate to me, or I wouldn't be able to relate to them. I was nervous about the whole safety setup, but during orientation, we were shown that the program officers can see into the programming rooms. They can't hear what we're saying, but they can see into the rooms. And there's a red duress button that you can push if something happens that makes you uncomfortable, if you feel unsafe. So I went in for the first time, and I was sort of, it's unnerving to go through all those locked doors, but I knew I would be able to leave again. And I went into that room, and two women who had decided to do the class got brought from their locked pod and into that room where I was, that locked room where I was waiting for them. And they were just women. Although in the year I've been doing this, I've added a few elements like a check-in, sometimes breathing and visualization exercises, gifts of notebooks so that they're able to write in between our sessions. The structure of the class is quite simple. Either I or one of them suggests a prompt. We all write on that topic together. And then we share if we want to, and people don't have to share if they don't want to. It's really, the goal of it, the idea is that in writing in that way, in that kind of automatic way, you get some distance from your feelings or your experiences, and you're able to give shape and meaning to them. For me, I find the most powerful thing that writing and sharing writing together in community feels like building community. It feels itself like a form of support. So that first day with these women, I'll call Shelley and Mindy, we wrote about dreams. And then, because Shelley asked, we wrote on the prompt, "How's the weather outside?" I understood why she was asking and acknowledged that. And shared what the weather was outside and said I understood that that was an uncomfortable reality. And they wrote of wishing they knew what the weather was like outside and missing summer activities. And then I did an exercise that I'd picked up in a writing workshop. I took out a dictionary, and Shelley opened the dictionary to a random page. And then Mindy, eyes closed, pointed to a word, monarch butterfly. The room went electric. Both of the women pulled down her orange, each of the women pulled down her orange smock to reveal her clavicle. Shelley had a large butterfly, life-size butterfly, in blue, orange, and green tattooed on her clavicle. It was stunningly beautiful. And Mindy had a smaller butterfly, dark blue, monochrome, tattooed on her collarbone. We talked then about the symbol of, for them, of butterflies, of metamorphosis, of having some possibility of change. We talked about the kind of sense of flight, freedom of flight of butterflies. We talked about their fragility, the short lives of Luna Maz and Mindy's mother's death. And in that hour, we had the space of freedom, of a sense of sharing, writing, and sharing together when no one's listening, no one's surveilling, and the natural light of human connection. Thank you.
Thanks to Teresa Alto. Here's a song from Cuban artist Leonis Lopez with Como la Mariposa.
Mariposa que llegó con sus colores y alegró mi jardín entristecido y sin flores. Eres la poesía, el canto del ruiseñor, como aquel sueño loco, eres mi primer amor. cuando siento tus caricias y tu forma de besar. Aunque esté dormida, vida, no quisiera despertar. ¿Hasta cuándo este amor logrará acompañarme? No sé si estoy delirando, no quisiera equivocarme. La mariposa que llegó con sus colores y alegró mi jardín entristecido y sin flores. Eres la poesía, el canto del ruiseñor, como aquel sueño loco, eres mi primer amor. Cuando siento tus caricias y tu forma de besar, aunque esté dormida, vida, no quisiera despertar. ¿Hasta cuándo este amor logrará acompañarme? No sé si estoy delirando, no quisiera equivocarme.
Today on Stay Human, we're hearing some of the stories told live at the Authentic Voice Storytelling Concert. The concert was emceed by storyteller Lauren Neamey. He told a few stories, too, but unlike the rest of us, he hadn't been thinking hard for a week about what stories to tell, let alone needing to practice them. He has so many stories, and he's told them so many times that he let the mood of the moment determine what he decided to share with us. Here's another one of the stories he told.
When I was in college, I was at the University of Minnesota. I was living on Nicollet Island. Nicollet Island, which is literally an island in the Mississippi River, city of Minneapolis on one side, what was St. Anthony on the other, now city of Minneapolis on the other. Hennepin Avenue crosses Nicollet Island. And at the time, in 1968, 1969, it was not like it is now. In 1968, 1969, on both sides of Hennepin Avenue, there were buildings, two and three, four-story buildings. On the first floor was commercial. Island Bicycle Shop, Jerry's Sporting, Mitch's Liquor, just one after another. And above it, on the second, third floors, there were rooms to rent, or some people would say flop houses. It was kind of interesting because the variety was quite wide. You could have rooms that rented by the night. You could have rooms that rented by the week. You could have rooms that rented by the month. You could have rooms which had walls that went all the way up. You could have rooms which had a closet. You could rent rooms that, my God, absolute luxury. You could rent rooms that had a bathroom, not down the hall. And these rooms were mostly occupied by veterans of the Second World War and the Korean War, by guys who worked for the railroad or guys who had some drinking issues or other kinds of issues. The equation was need cheap space. And it was a lively community. Now, there was one particular guy by the name of Tommy. Everyone called him Tommy the Wino. He was an interesting guy because he didn't speak much, but he would appear sort of out of the shadows, and he wouldn't really say anything. He'd just put his hand out and kind of shake it. And if you gave him a dime or if you gave him a dollar, it didn't make any difference. He would all say the same thing. Thank you. And I would see him occasionally as I was on my way to driving taxi, or more often I would see him on the way back from driving taxi in the morning. And one day I decided I wanted to know a little bit about him. And so when I saw him, I grabbed him and I said, "Tommy, today is your lucky day. Today I am buying you a bottle." And I wheeled him and myself into Mitch's liquor store. Mitch's was an interesting place. It was a long, narrow space. There were shelves of liquor. There was a chain link fence down the middle with a little tiny aisle, sort of going into a prison, right? And at the far end, there was a counter where Mitch or his brother stood. The principle, I think, was that if you could put money on the counter, you could buy, regardless of your age or your condition. And so I say, "Tommy, what would you like?" And I'm thinking, you know, he would, you know, something in the good wine category or maybe even whiskey. But right away, he goes down to the bottom shelf to the cheapest rotgun wine he could find. Mogan David 2020. $2.79 a pint. "Tommy, are you sure you don't want something better?" So, show Mitch, pay for it, walk out with our paper bag. I say, "Tommy, now what?" And he goes, and we go down and we slip into the beneath the bridge on the east side of the island. On the west side of the island is where St. Anthony Falls is. It's where the current is strong and the city is all in its glory across the Roay. But on the east side, you're looking from a wooded bank towards another wooded bank towards a series of older buildings. And down underneath there, it was like a bower. Dragonflies on the surface of the water, frogs croaking. Tommy and I are sitting there, and he takes the bottle and cracks it open and takes a sip and hands the bag and the bottle to me. And I realize I have my first question: what is the proper etiquette? And he says to me, "You can wipe." So I wipe the top of the bottle and I take a sip, and I'm telling you, it burned in my mouth, it burned in my throat, it burned all the way down, and I thought, "Oh, I'm gonna feel this even as it leaves me." And I handed the bottle back to him, and he took a sip, and he handed it back to me. Now, I didn't say much, but at some point he began to talk, and he began to say to me, "Are you going to school, kid?" And I said, "Yeah, I am." He says, "Good, that's good. You should do that." And I said, "Did you go to school?" And he said, "Oh, no, not for a long time." And I said, "Were you ever married?" And he said, "Oh, no, not for a long time." And then all of a sudden, he sort of changed it, and he says, "Do you know how to fish for chickens?" "What?" And he says, "Yeah," he says, "all the railroad guys, we all know that. You get a can of corn and you get a safety pin and you put some kernels of corn on the end of the safety pin. And when the boxcar is stopped and the chickens are out there, you toss out the line. And when they peck the corn, you yank them into the boxcar and you've got dinner." It sounded so much easier than I think it actually was. We drank until we came to the end of the bottle. And he stood up and he took the last few drops and he shook them into the water, into the river, and said, "For the spirits." And I stood up, and as I stood up, I recognized the meaning of the word swoon for the first time. The blood just rushed out of me and my legs went weak. And even as I started to fall, Tommy reached out and grabbed me and pulled me up. Upright. It was the first time he had touched me in any way. And when I turned to thank him, he was gone. He had disappeared. So I did what I was going to do. I went back to my place and I took a long nap. And I began to look for him because I didn't see him for a couple of days. I didn't see him at all. And then finally one day as I was coming off a driving taxi, I saw him down at the end of the block and I ran up to him and I grabbed hold of him. And he looked at me like, oh, why are you touching me? And I said, Tommy, I just have to know, why haven't you asked me for money? And he said, why would I ask you for money? You drank with me. You're one of us.
About me when I'm gone. That's the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. I'm Michael Goldberg. Thanks for tuning in today. And my thanks to Lauren Nimi, Teresa Alto, and Rebecca Zemanski. Join us this time next week for part two of the Authentic Voice live storytelling concert. And meantime, you know, just stay human.
This one's dedicated to all the freaky people out there. All us lovely freaks and weirdos. Trying to make it through life, you know what I'm saying? Sometimes it's rough out there. Just try to keep a sense of humor. Try to stay human, you know what I'm saying? Starvation is a creation of the devil, a rebel. I'm bringing food to the people like a widow. Bringing flowers to a grave in the middle of the city. Isolation is a riddle. To be surrounded by a million other people, but feel alone like a tree in the desert. Dried up like the skin of a lizard, but full of color like the spots of a leopard. Drum and bass pull me in like a shepherd. Scratch my itch like a needle on a record. Full of life like a man going to Mecca. Sky high like an eagle up soaring. I speak low but I'm like a lion roaring. Baritone like a Robeson recording. I'm giving thanks for being human every morning. Morning, morning. Because the streets are alive with the sound of boom-bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom, bah. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every box got a right to be booming. Because the streets are alive with the sound of boom, bah. Can I hear it once again? Boom, bah. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a right to be booming. Be resistant. The negativity, we keep it at a distance. Call for backup and I give you some assistance. Like a lifesaver deep in the ocean. Stay afloat here upon the funky motion. Rock and roll upon the waves of the season. Hold your breath and your underwater breathing. To be rhyming without a real reason is to claim but not to practice a religion. If television is the drug of the nation, satellite is immaculate reception. Beaming in, they can look and they can listen. So you see, don't believe in the system to legalize you or give you your freedom. You want rights? Ask them, they'll read them. But every flower got a right to be blooming. Stay human, because the streets are alive with the sound of boom-bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom-bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every box got a right to be booming. Because the streets are alive with the sound of boom-bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom-bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a right to be blooming. Because all the freaky people make the beauty of the world. Of the world. Because all the freaky people make the beauty of the world. Stay human. See why 2K and O is the moment. In time we find that we can open up a heart that's locked or been broken by the pain of words not spoken, nor shot by guns or still smoking. Cartwrights out on the Ponderosa, or drive by banging Testarossa. We need to heed the words of Dalai Lama, or at least the words of your mama. Take a mental trip to the Bahamas, steam your body in the stereo sauna, sauna, comma. Because Cause the streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every box got a right to be booming. Because the streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it?